Welcome back to The Word at Work. This is the podcast for Christian professionals where we dig into topics to support you in thriving professionally and of greatest importance living biblically. I'm your host, Miranda Carls. Well, today we are welcoming Dave Evans to the show. Dave is co-director of the Stanford Life Design Lab and co-founder of Electronic Arts, one of the world's largest interactive entertainment companies. He's also co-author of three books, the number one New York Times bestseller, Designing Your Life, Designing Your Work Life, and Designing Your New Work Life. Well, Dave, thanks so much for making time for the conversation.
Miranda, good to be here.
Yeah, now you have a background in design thinking, of course, and some cool product design experience. I actually learned that you led the design of Apple's first mouse and laser printer. Is that right?
That's true.
Yeah. So that would have been obviously in the very early days of Apple. Did you work directly with Steve Jobs?
I did work very closely with Steve. And oddly enough, just last night, so I turned 70 this coming Sunday, which happens to be Easter Sunday of 2023. And a few days ago, my namesake, David John the sixth, I'm David John Evans the fourth, my son's the fifth, his son's, who's known as Duke, is the sixth. Uh-huh. And the sixth just turned nine, which is, you know, kind of epic. And my son's also a designer. He's a real designer. I'm just sort of a design strategist. He's actually a design product maker. And he decided, as his son was about to turn nine, which was kind of a legacy moment, because when I was nine, my father died, and we later learned he died of suicide. You know, so my grandson's turning the age that I was fatherless, and his father was thinking about that.
Yeah.
And so he just literally went back and he did all the research on the history of the mouse. And he found an original edition, an early edition mouse from Apple going back to the 80s. And in so doing, found the computer archives at the Stanford records, which include a bunch of my memos going out to the guys on the Lisa team at Apple talking about the P3 mouse and this kind of stuff. And he has recreated an antique mouse using new internals, which I just saw last night for the first time. So the mouse story is really on my mind.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did get to work with Steve on the mouse. I distributed the first 30 prototypes of the P3 internal mouse in December of 1980.
Wow.
He sent me a copy of an email I wrote while he was in the womb, as it turned out. not a podcast relevant anecdote, but it's on my mind.
No, anyway. I love it. I'm sure designing the first Apple mouse has to make you like the coolest grandpa ever, I'm sure.
Well, I project managed it. I was a product manager, and Bill Lapson was head of the engineering team and Hubby Kelly. So the famous design firm now known as IDEO, which was previously David Kelly Design, which was previously Hubby Kelly. So Hubby Kelly Design, which is what became IDEO three generations later, that was one of their first projects. So the guys that really designed the mouse are the guys that are now IDEO. And I product managed it. So I'm the guy that, you know, I'm the midwife that made sure the baby got born.
Okay. Cool. Good deal. Well, I'm a loyal Apple products user, so I have so many questions, but we do need to stay focused on the biggest reason I reached out. So I'll stop. I'm getting distracted just being interested in that. We're going to discuss designing your life and what that might look like from a Christian perspective. Before we get into that, let's look at the core of designing your life methodology. For anyone who maybe hasn't read the book or isn't familiar with your work, what is life design, just in a soundbite?
Well, again, for your readership, I mean, this really comes out of my own, you know, 45-year pursuit of trying to figure out what the heck I'm supposed to do in my own life. And I found both, you know, the university world and the career centers there and the Christian world, the church and the elders and the counselors there, all profoundly useless in that pursuit back in the 70s when I was, you know, 19, 20 years old. So it's kind of trying to figure out how to figure out what God's trying to tell you about what to do with your life that has been at the root of this thing that finally turned into what became now Designing Your Life. So in a sense, it's a very fair thing to say that designing your life is simply the Christian doctrine of vocational discernment reframed through the lens of design thinking. You know, and Todd Bolsinger, the executive vice president of Fuller Seminary, very successful pastor and author, and I were chatting about that exact idea in the coffee house at Stanford some years ago, and he goes, "I finally figured out, Dave, why we get along so well." Because design thinking and practical theology are exactly the same thing. And practical theology is a very specific systemic perspective on theological development, which is empirical. So the designing your life methodology, you know, this, the centerpiece of design thinking is prototype iteration. You can't know the future. So the only way you get there is build it. You have to go out and do things together with other people, like the Christian walk. There is no right answer. There's walking rightly. It's not Christianity, you know, got turned into a noun, but what it really is a verb. You know, the early Christians were known as followers in the way. Jesus' answer to the question is, I'm the way. I'm not the answer. I'm the way. It's how we go is a lot more important than where we're going. The what. In fact, even, you know, Thomas specifically, you know, it's Holy Week, right? Well, during Holy Week, Thomas said, hey, how do we know the way if we don't know where you're going? And Jesus says, no, I am the way. It's not destination based. It's journey based. So designing life methodology is how to become more competent, what, you know, we call it a vocational competency, in finding your way. And the way you find your way is you have some ideas, you go out, you talk to a lot of people, you try some stuff out, you iterate that process, you know, rather intentionally until you find a point of engagement that really works, you know, and then you start building a life around that. So that's what, you know, we've just been helping people get unstuck for the past about 17 years. And apparently, you know, that seems to be hitting a chord, because we just crossed about 1 million copies of the book in 23 languages. And, you know, we're being taught on like 1400 campuses around the world, 400 campuses around the world. And so something's going on.
Yeah. Well, fantastic book. I first read it several years ago, and many conversations I have had with clients over the years have lent themselves to these concepts. I've recommended your book to many clients, but it wasn't until a few months ago that I learned that you yourself were a Christian, and then found that Christian Companion that you wrote, that 13-page right. document. What prompted you to write that Christian Companion to the Designing Your Life book? Were you getting a lot of questions about applying the concepts as a Christian?
So, I mean, I had been teaching in the faith and work movement for decades, you know. In fact, that's really where I got started. In fact, I was chatting about ministry with a guy named Randy Baer, who was at the time working for the graduate division of InterVarsity and was also an ordained Presbyterian minister and running a place called Westminster House, a large privately owned Presbyterian denomination owned community residence for students that had been at UC Berkeley for 100 years. It's still there. Sadly, it's no longer Presbyterian. They, you know, after he left, the next director kind of blew it. Frankly, they had to sell it to handle debt. So it's now a secular place, but still a lovely place. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, we're chatting. This is like 1990. Mm-hmm. And he said, gosh, Dave, you know, everybody has these questions. You ought to teach a class. So I started teaching a class at Berkeley called Finding Your Vocation, subtitled Is Your Calling. And I actually taught at a secular university, specifically through the lens of Christian discernment. But I taught it as an historical technology transfer concept, not as a proselytizing, you know, recruiting concept. And that worked fine. By the time I was done, 80% of my students were not Christian, because everybody's desperate for this. What do I do with the rest of my one wild and wonderful life, as the poet put it? You know, and my partner at Stanford is an atheist. You know, I'm the Jesus-loving Christian. He's the Nietzsche-loving atheist. And we get along fine.
Yeah,
because all you have to do, if Jesus is the second Adam, right, and we do, and the technical name of design thinking is human-centered design, what I say, in fact, it's in that paper, is if you get the human part right, you can't go wrong. Because I will argue that the fundamental calling of becoming a human being that Jesus gives us as the incarnational calling of the second Adam is to become fully human. So if you become fully human, you're on the right path. And frankly, if your consciousness about the God who's the ground of all being on which that humanity gets expressed is coming a little later in the story, that's okay. We can still work with you too. So it's a massively inclusive orientation. But along the way, having talked in the work in faith integration theology question, we go, okay, great. I now understand that the sacred secular gap is nonsense, that my whole life should be an expression of the glory of God. Great. How the heck do you do that? I used to just wonder, oh, am I supposed to be a minister or a missionary and do God's work? or just go be, a secular waste of time, but I'll make money and give it to the people doing God's work. So that's the way, 90% of Christians badly thought for the last two centuries. Once you get over that problem, like, oh, I could be doing godly work almost anywhere, not anywhere literally, not, but nonetheless, now I've got this discernment problem. So we're in that question heavily. And so when we came up with the design thinking based version of this thing, then, Christians who are really interested in figuring stuff out and don't have very good tools flocked to the book as well. And they wanted the rest of the backstory. So the reason that paper came out and the reason I often, am in front of Christian groups is I teach it the same way, but I just turn the Christian closed captioning on. So the it's not a different idea for Christians at all. I don't change anything.
Right.
When I quote teach designing life in a Christian context, I just add a couple of more notes.
Yeah. I love that you highlighted the nonsense of the secular sacred divide, and you do that in the document as well. We talk about that a lot on here. It sounds like some of the pushback you get probably before people even read the book, but just at face value is the concept of designing your life. That sounds like it takes God out of the picture. Again, I don't think they'd walk away from that if they actually read the content, but there's almost something very passive.
And that is the big question is, I mean, just the title of the book is offensive. Designing your life. No. God designs my life.
Right.
So, whoa. And so the whole idea is, what's the fundamental nature of the relationship between God and man? I mean, so Hendrikof Burkhoff's systemic theology talks about the subject-object relationship. In other words, God's the subject and I'm the object. You're the creator, I'm the creation. Just tell me what to do. Now you're in puppet land. Okay, that's not what God made.
No.
God made a consciousness-bearing, image-bearing reality, but neither are we fully autonomous. Like, I'm the subject and God's the object. Not to be offensive, but that's where fundamentalism goes. Like, I know God so well, I can tell him what to do. God obeys the rules I made up for him. Nah, it doesn't really work that way. So now, I'm in charge of reality, as opposed to, a subject-subject relationship, meaning I have autonomy in meaning-making, God's sovereign, and my autonomy operates freely within the sovereignty of God, which is a very complex concept. It's paradoxical, but it turns out God's sovereignty is not diminished by my freedom. So now we have to find a way where there's this co-collaboration, where I'm involved in working with God and reality to navigate my life into a meaningful expression. And there's more than one right answer. So this whole idea of once you get to the place that you realize, there's not just one simple right answer and I'm either right or wrong, then it gets really interesting and really difficult.
Kind of that act of prototyping with God, and he's in it all.
Yeah, prototyping with God. That's right. And you may very well get a vote.
Yeah, there's something kind of, I think, passive about that question of, well, doesn't design thinking take God out of the picture? God is always in the picture. We can't take him out, and we are to build our lives with Jesus as the focal point. But we're also called to be active, to seize those opportunities, to co-create.
Right. For many people, the model is what's your model of discernment? And I'm a believer in active discernment.
Yeah.
And so, there's this, I mean, we call it wayfinding, and Christianity is a way. So as you're making your way, you discover what's going on. We have Jesus encountering the Syrophoenician woman where, the game changes and he starts out by saying, I'm really supposed to, I'm called just to talk to the Jews. Well, hey, we count too. I mean, Jesus literally changes over time. Peter massively changes over time. I mean, look at the very first miracle Jesus does. The wedding, first public miracle, wedding at Cana. Now, by the way, these are not mainline preferred concepts of biblical understanding, but most Christians eisegetically read the word. They start with the answer and then go look for proof texting. They don't read what's actually there. So Jesus goes to this wedding, right? Big party, gets up, puts on the clean tunic that morning. Off he goes. We're at the party and they run out of wine. And then Mary walks up and says, they've run out of wine. And then he says, woman, my time has not yet come. Then she says, do whatever he says. Then he says, go get the jars. we're doing this thing. Okay, with all due respect, that scene doesn't work. My time has not yet come. For most people listening, Jesus is sinless. Jesus is perfect. Jesus is the 200% super guy, knows the Father really, really, really well, got up that morning, knew full well that morning while he was putting on the clean tunic, going to the party. Today's not the day. Today's not the day for Jesus to come out. He's at the party, and mom says, we throw Mary under the bus. Probably being Protestant is you throw Mary under the bus. Look, nobody asked me to be the place where the incarnation got started. And so she says, she notices something, but she doesn't go, hey, honey, do that thing you do. She doesn't do that. She kind of goes, I just noticed something, and the Spirit is prompting me to bring it to your attention. That's my job. Now, your job is to decide what to do with that. And he goes, Mom, I'm sorry, still not today. And she goes, she didn't go, hey, I think it is, son. Talk to me. She didn't say that. She just turns to the guys and says, whatever. Now, at that point, Jesus has a way out. Jesus could very easily say, look, here's $20. Go down to 7-Eleven, pick up a couple of six packs. I'm sorry they ran out of stuff. I'm happy to help out. Very easily done. There's nothing about Mary's commentary that forces him to go into miracle making. So either, and I've heard many torturous descriptions of what went on there that try to skip over the reality that what really happened is Jesus changes his mind. That morning, he was not the public ministry guy. That night, he was. Somewhere in the seconds between woman, my time has not yet come, and do whatever he says, a movement occurs in him that, frankly, I will argue doesn't happen without Mary's help, meaning none of us can do this alone, that says, oh, it is today. As a matter of fact, it is. I didn't see this coming. Now, I think what's encouraging about that is when Jesus woke up that morning not knowing, he had done exactly nothing wrong. His job at that point is to continue to living into the invitation of the Spirit in a way that the constant motion toward full realization of your identity gets to the place where you've allowed the Spirit to grow you to a place where you have the capacity to even hear the next invitation. I don't think Jesus was ready at 8 that morning to know that today was miracle day. That Jesus hadn't arrived yet. He didn't show up until about 3:47 in the afternoon at the party. And that was the time. And that's when the Spirit said, Mary, I need you to give the boy a nudge. And she gives the nudge, and he rejects it. And she kind of goes, okay, I've done, this is what walking in the way looks like. So I think it is stunningly encouraging that Jesus' first miracle is an instance, according to my interpretation, of what I call the just-in-time God. The just-in-time God where you live into the invitation you do understand, not in order to get it right or pull off the transaction, but in order to simply grow into the person who can hear the next thing. John 5:19, I do only what the Father shows me. All you're trying to do in this life is grow into the person who can catch the next invitation. And that's what designing your life does. Talk to people and try stuff. Prototypes are the auger dishes, petri dishes, in which you allow the Holy Spirit to grow the gift of insight. You're just giving God a chance to talk to you. Sitting on the couch and agonizing. Tell me, God, just tell me. I'll do what you want me to do. That's not going to help. It's sincere. Right. We have a lot of sincere, incompetent discernment going on. You know, get out there on the street. Here's a staff. Here's a bag. I know you guys don't know what you're doing. I mean, when Jesus sends out the disciples in pairs, they are massively undertrained, totally incompetent. It's an on-the-job training program.
Yeah.
You'll figure it out when you get there. That's the deal. That's all we're trying to help people do.
Yeah. Good. Such good alignment there. And you do a really good job in that document unpacking it. One question you answer that I'd love for you to speak to a little bit here is around spiritual disciplines. So how do those spiritual disciplines of prayer, Bible reading specifically, fit in with the Design Your Life methodology?
Sure. And that really goes back to almost, again, back to the sacred secular gap. I'm going to refer to that theologically. Why? Because underneath what we're talking about here is the decision about what is your cosmological view So Stephen Garber, who's probably a guy you know the name of, who wrote Fabric of Faithfulness. He's a fabulous work of faith guy, and Visions of Vocation, a lovely guy, PhD in cultural hermeneutics, meaning how to understand where we live. Been around this same issue for many, many years along with me. He's one of the other gray hairs. And in his book, he talks about the people who live what I call the coherent life, he'd call the integrated faithful life. Three things are evident: a telos sufficient for their praxis, a community of like-mindedness, and mentors and supporters. And a telos sufficient for your praxis, and he has a PhD, so he has to talk like that, means a great big idea, a theory of everything that holds your actual lived life, your praxis life, your not merely your orthodoxy, but your orthopraxy. So in the sacred secular gap, the problem is if you're using a Platonic dualistic understanding of reality, which is that materiality and spirituality are fundamentally different and don't have anything to do with each other, and that's why you're trying to cross the gap and be a philosopher, because you want to be more spiritual, less material. Material doesn't really matter. That's not a biblical worldview. A biblical worldview is a unitivist mindset that, in fact, what we have is, you know, spirit-filled reality called persons, and you know, and so all of creation is God's first, you know, revelation, right? So that, you know, Paul says, if you can just, that the world will tell you the divine nature of God if you can see things the way they really are. All of creation is screaming out the nature of the Creator, if you can but have eyes to see. So what we're talking about there in this whole idea about Christianity is we're moving into an incarnationality. So what that says is, I'm not just doing transactions. It's not just figure out the answer to what job I should take and then go do it. Most people take discernment as a transaction. If I now actually believe that all of reality is a place where the kingdom of God exists, if I can see it, and my job is to live in it as much as I possibly can, including, and when big decisions like marry her or not, move or not, take the job or not, quit or not, those moments are really important. Is it time to turn toward Jerusalem or keep hanging out in Samaria and Galilee? So those decisions really matter, but they're not the whole point. Everything is the whole point. And so if we're going to do that, the way that we maintain access to and growth in the ongoing flow of walking in the Spirit is through practices. Yeah, I haven't forgotten your question. What are practices? And practices are things you do all the time. A practice is not a transaction like, oh, big test coming up, better cram all the stuff before the final. Okay. That's the way most people do spiritual disciplines. They try to cram before the final, like, oh my God, I have to change this job. I know I should fast this week. I should pray this week. I should have somebody lay hands on me, maybe douse me in oil, like do it all, you know, for a week, and then make the big decision. Whew, okay. Don't take the job. Mm-hmm. I'm good. We're done. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's not practices. Okay. That's just drugs. I mean, and by the way, I'm not saying you don't spike your spiritual activity during moments of intensity. Sure you do. But real practices are things you do all the time. They're the aerobic training, mm-hmm. right? And so, and each of us has to find this. So, you know, Thomas Merton's definition of spirituality, which is a word a lot of Christians are scared of because the New Agers use it too. Look, spirit, you know, we knew the spirit a long time ago. Don't worry if there's just a small S in front of the word. It's not going to hurt you. Spirituality simply means one's own manner of intimacy with the divine. That's a lovely definition. One's own manner of intimacy with the divine. You know, hey, all couples have to figure out what's our love language. What's our way of being. So in your love language with God, your set of disciplines and practices want to be taken from the ones that the tradition has deeply understood over the years. So, you know, community and support and prayer and I mean, all these litany thing, you know, Robert Foster and Dallas Willard are really good at talking about that stuff. Go read those books. And then you start experimenting. What are the ways, and they change over time, what are the ways in which you can maintain that reality that aims your attention and your intention toward the ongoing walk of being in the Spirit? And I think you have to have some. If you want to grow character, if you want to grow soul, you have to have practices. That's where becoming a discerning person comes from. You got to get past transaction and into practice. If you want to become a person who walks that way, not just who every, 2 to 6 years makes a big decision that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So much of this comes down to, back to, the prior point, just not compartmentalizing things or creating that divide, but weaving all of that into the entirety of our lives. So good. Well, since I'm speaking with the author of Designing Your Life, I do have a question. I really appreciate the dysfunctional beliefs and reframes that you have all throughout the book.
Yep.
And I'll link to all three books and the Christian Companion Guide in the show notes.
And it's really too, the Designing Your New Work Life is the second edition of the first one. So just skip the middle one.
Okay.
It's the second edition. The second book, it has all of the third book, as you call it, has everything in the second book already there, plus four new chapters and a new introduction. So skip the second one. It's just the new one. Make sure if you buy the workbook, it's got the word new on it. Then you're going to get the good book.
Yeah, good. Well, I'll link to the new appropriate ones. One of my favorite dysfunctional beliefs and reframes was work is not supposed to be enjoyable. That's why they call it work. And that's reframed in the book as, quote, enjoyment is a guide to finding the right work for you, quote. I'm curious, as one of the authors, is there a dysfunctional belief or two that are particularly meaningful to you or that you've personally worked through a lot in your own life?
Well, I would say probably... it's really the Christian variation on what's your passion, is what's God's will for your life.
Yeah.
Have you found God's will? Are you sure you're doing God's will?
That one big thing. Yeah.
That one big thing. That you are the one incredibly special snowflake that there is something that God needs done in the world that you and you alone could possibly do. That's why God made you the one exact snowflake that you are, because there's a little place in the jigsaw puzzle where your piece goes and no other piece goes.
You're
late. First of all, and I just think that's, I was about to say nonsense, and that sounds dismissive to the people who are still hoping that that's the case. I don't mean to be dismissive, but I think it's absolutely untrue. I think it's unbiblical, and I think it's terribly unhelpful.
Yeah, and there's an arrogance to it also.
It's really an attractive idea. Mm-hmm. Now, the truth is the overwhelming majority of people who have that idea don't really necessarily have super high confidence that they have found it, right? So an awful lot of people have died a little sad that they don't think they found it. And in so doing, somehow they failed God. And that is a real tragedy. The reason being, first of all, you have to understand, we're coming up on Holy Week, and have this mind among you that was also in Christ Jesus, who did not hold equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, Now, so the mind of Christ means your self-concept matters tremendously. It does not say that equality with God was not a thing that was true. It says a thing not to be grasped. And that includes two elements. Grasping is reaching, or as I'm not reaching for, not I gotta go get it. He's not doing that. And not even to be held. So the fullness of the expression of who Jesus is, which is equality with God, right? Colossians tells us the fullness of God is pleased to dwell in him. So in some mystical way we can't possibly understand, all of God feels comfortable inside Jesus' skin. Doesn't make any sense. You got to trust that. But Jesus is not attempting to express all of that. He's only attempting to express what needs to be done, which isn't the fullness. The fullness of God is pleased to dwell in him, and it doesn't all get out. He doesn't even try to hold it. Which means, intrinsically, we got less of Jesus than there was. And I would argue that that is true of all human, that statement is not unique to the Messiah. So Miranda, in humility, did not hold equality with 100% full Miranda-ness, a thing to be grasped, but emptied herself and humbly allowed herself to be merely a person living one mortal life that expressed God, but not in every way it possibly could have been experienced. So that's Dave's expanded version.
That's good.
And I believe, so that's the kenotic understanding, right? The kenosis is the Greek word for not, for the emptying out. And so what's going on there is all of us are less than, expressed less than we are. All of us can see things we're not going to get to do. All of us are going to experience missing out. And you just get to decide whether or not it's the fear of missing out or the joy of missing out. And if you, if you're really in the gospel, you're learning what the joy of missing out is all about, because it is in that, that finite particularity that you get to experience grace. In fact, it is literally, I will argue, theologically, that the space made between us by my withholding, I'm not doing all Dave all the time. If I am, I'm just on broadcast constantly. You've got to leave room for community. You've got to, when two or three are gathered, I'm in their midst. And if you don't leave room for those other two or three to breathe, Jesus doesn't show up. You have to hold back. It's the specific space occupies is the space that is made by the retraction of my ego, the retraction of my, I have to have all of me expressed all the time. The world defines fulfillment as I got to do all of me. Christianity defines fulfillment as I made room by holding back of me so that God can show up. It's a profoundly different way of, the gospel is so much more radical than people accept. It is so much more radical. And so that, so I have to find my passion, I have to find God's will, frankly, moves toward this, there has to be this one big, huge, wonderful thing that's just for me. And if I'm going to live kenotically, if I'm going to live with the mind of Christ, absolutely, there's whole big fat chunks of me that are never going to get expressed. And that's okay. Which means, by the way, it can't all be, oh, that's all the bad stuff, there's only one good thing. No, there's plenty of good stuff you're not going to get to do. Which means some of that passion is going to get left behind. Some of that stuff that looks like calling isn't going to get responded to. Jesus stands at the wall during Holy Week and says, "Oh, Jerusalem, had only you known at the time of your visitation," and he weeps. You know, a lot of people didn't get what he was saying, and it broke his heart. It didn't work. Some of it failed. You know, it wasn't all, you know, he says it's finished. He didn't say it was all done and wrapped up. He just says it's finished. My part's done here. I got to leave a whole bunch of undone things on my to-do list to the hands of these goofballs that are left behind. These goofballs who, by the way, at the Mount of Ascension, they're going, if you buy the story as written, they're walking up the hill. Look at the end of Matthew. And it says, you know, and as they ascended, you know, with the 70, and some doubted. It's post-resurrection. It's post-appearing and walking through walls. It's the 70 who've been with him the whole time. They're walking up the hill. He's about to hit the express elevator and disappear into the clouds. If you just read the story as written, you know, and there's a couple of guys back in the crowd who apparently are saying, like, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think he's really the guy? I'm so sure. You know, it's kind of like, and you're Jesus and you overhear that. You're eavesdrop, like, oh my God, they're still asking these questions. What do I freaking have to do? Like, rise from the dead? Oh, did that. What do I need to do? Like, walk on water? Oh, did that. What do you want from me? I mean, when he's done, not everybody got it. We're all going to leave undone things. We're all going to leave missed out. We're all going to leave lots of that. So, you know, this one, it's going to be totally fulfilling. And once I figure out God's will for my life, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be wonderful. I'm going to have no doubt whatsoever. That is not the biblical understanding.
Right.
Doubt is the necessary companion to faith. And the walk is always from the partially known to the even more less known. That's the deal. Now, so, you know, it's heaven all the way to heaven if you get it, and it's hell all the way to hell, but picking your mindset matters big time.
Yeah, that's good. Beautiful. Well, Dave, is there anything else that you'd like to share with the Christian professionals who are listening in today before we wrap up?
You know, I think, what I mostly want to be is I've sort of been speaking harshly about some bad ideas that people have had historically, because they do upset me. You know, we've been sincerely teaching bad stuff to people and crushing their souls for a long time. It just makes me mad.
Yes, Yeah.
But what I want people to be is encouraged. Look, God loves you. God was not taking a nap when you got born. Even if you're, and by the way, even if you're in a horrible situation, we live in a culture that says you have to be successful in order to be okay. And Viktor Frankl, you know, in Man's Search for Meaning, survives the Holocaust and realizes that some people, like the prisoners who died there, get in a situation where circumstantially they're so oppressed that none of their agency can be expressed other than the one thing that is never taken from us, which is our attitude to the situation in which we find ourselves. So if that is the only ground, for those of you who are struggling, if the only ground you're on right now as you're working through a tough time is how you get to hold the situation, do you continue to have hope? Do you continue to believe that God is real in the world, even though the fact that the dark side of free will is currently landing right on your head?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're in an abusive relationship, or you've got a horrible boss, or, you know, you ran out of money, or, you know, the kids got cancer. I mean, some really serious crap's going down. Like, I buried my wife 2 years ago, 15 years ahead of the contract. That was not the deal. You know, when stuff lands in your lap that you didn't choose, how do you hold, is God still there? And if you fall for the success gospel that the culture is in favor of, which is easily done, then, and you can, you know, Bible bullet your selections to reinforce it, you're going to end up in a place where you're going to be very self-judging. So the thing I most want to do is talk to those who are right now who are not only doubting God, you're doubting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, you probably didn't orchestrate the circumstances of your situation. Yeah, sure, you made a couple of moves that contributed. But at the end of the day, most of the important things in life happen to us, not from us. Life changes one of two ways, because we make a change or life changes on us. The big ones are almost always the latter. And so how you respond to what life has brought you is the issue, not, oh, now I can't start the company. Oh, now we're not going to get to move to Hawaii, or now we're not going to get to do whatever it is I wanted to do. That's not the issue. The issue is just, and what are you going to do now? Where do you take it from here? That's all God's asking of you. There's a great line in the book, Abandonment to Divine Providence by Jean-Pierre de Caussade, that says, you know, the only thing God is asking of you is to do all of his will all of the time.
All the time. Mm-hmm.
What could be easier? Because, of course, the God who dearly loves you would never ask of you anything you can't do. I think that's, when I first read that, I went like, oh, this guy's in a different place than I am. That is not the way I would have perceived that. So
yeah.
I think that's the invitation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the time the story is over, first time Peter meets Jesus and realizes who he is, drops to his knees and says, depart from me, I'm an unclean man. The last time he sees Jesus in the flesh is when he's fishing after the resurrection, and it's the you know, beach on the breakfast on the beach scene at Capernaum, when he's caught fishing when he's not supposed to be. You know, Peter goes, I'm going fishing. And he goes back, and he's like, he's supposed to be waiting in Jerusalem. He goes, I'm going fishing. I'm going to go do what I know how to do. And they're out there fishing, catch nothing all night, and Jesus says, hey, not recognizing, but hey, children, throw the net on the other side of the boat. Wait a minute. Been there, done that. I've seen this happen before. Same thing, all the fish show up. And what happens to Peter at that point? Peter, who is caught freaking red-handed doing the wrong thing at the wrong time in the wrong place. Again. And knows better now. What does he do? He goes, it's the Lord. Jumps out of the boat, swims to the beach. While he's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Of screwing up and missing the call, he is so drawn to Jesus, he can't wait. Swims half naked to hit the beach. The transition between Peter's first meeting and Peter's last meeting, something really changed. The affection, the love, the draw, the attractiveness of Jesus far overcomes his sense of guilt. That's the God you want to be hanging out with.
Mm, good. Yeah, well, that's a beautiful place, I think, to end things today. Thank you so much, Dave, for the conversation. And I will link to the books and all the great resources in the show notes. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks so much. Miranda, blessings on your work, and thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Word at Work. If you enjoy this podcast or get something good out of it, be sure to like, subscribe, and the biggest compliment you can give us is to share this episode with friends. Thanks so much again for tuning in, and we will see you next time.